welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is Professor Stepan Mestrovic. Stepan is a professor of sociology at Texas A&M University. He has done so much. We've had Stepan on the program before. We've talked about his work dealing with the U.S. soldiers on trial. The book that I have written about and we've discussed in this program is called The Good Soldier on Trial, A Sociological Study of Misconduct by the U.S. Military Pertaining to Operation Iron Triangle Iraq. And what it's all about in a nutshell is when the commanders and the people on up the ranks to the very top commit crimes, a few lower-level patsies occasionally take a fall. And that's what the book is all about. And Stepan has a new one out, or at least a newer one out. It's called Strike and Destroy. I'll let him talk about it on air a little bit. It's basically on the same theme, I think. And this is what he does and spends a lot of time on. And it's a very important issue because, you know, the orders on a waging war and who to attack and who to kill and who to save and all the things related to wars and conflict, the ordinary soldiers in the field have nothing to do with those things. You know, they go where they're ordered to go, and they do what they're told to do. And if they don't do it, even if it means killing and committing crimes, if they don't do it, they don't follow orders, they could be court-martialed, and they could be sent to prison. So that's the rock in the hard place these young kids are up against. It's a very tough situation, but, of course, the law is the law, and that's inviolable. You'd never know it the way America runs its foreign and domestic policy anyway. Stepan, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
It's good to have you back. It's been a good while.
It's a pleasure.
Oh, it's a joy to have you back. Let's jump in wherever you want, either your newest book or maybe something else you want to jump into.
Well, I think my newest book is relevant to what's going on right now between Israel and Gaza and many other hotspots. Strike and Destroy is about Stryker Brigade, Fort Lewis. And in the year 2010, several low-ranking soldiers randomly killed Afghan civilians. The focus was all about the soldiers killing the civilians, but further investigation for the courts-martial, where I was an expert witness in sociology, revealed that the brigade's motto was strike and destroy, and that the brigade commander was pushing an aggressive fighting philosophy, which was at the time going against the coin doctrine, counterinsurgency, which was being put forth of all people by General Petraeus and General McChrystal. And it's now 2012, only 2 years later. The coin strategy of winning hearts and minds, of having tea with the village elders, of building roads and infrastructure as a way to not win militarily, but to win diplomatically, if you will, or win socially, that's just been put completely in the back burner. So the general theme that I've been pursuing lately is that no matter how many Geneva Conventions you have in place and laws of armed conflict and rules against attacking civilians and women and children, it seems like at least since the 1990s in wars, it's been a strike-and-destroy philosophy, from drone strikes to all these brigades that basically the orders are just like the title says, destroy without regard for civilian casualties. And I think that's a very disturbing trend.
It really is disturbing, Stepan. And I think the reality of the way America fights its wars is this is the same kind of stuff that's gone on as far back as you want to go to the beginning. Way back in the early 19th century, even the 18th century, there was no justice, no quarter given Native Americans. I mean, they were just lauded. There were no Geneva Conventions around at that time, but there were laws, domestic. Not sure about international laws. I think they get started much later than that, maybe later in the 19th century, early 20th century. But there's certainly a domestic laws against murder, and murder is just committed with abandon, and America goes around killing whoever it wants. Let me just mention that because I wanted to, what you're talking about is relevant to what's going on in the Middle East, specifically Gaza, and that's been a major focus for me. And ahead of our Thanksgiving weekend, we're taping this on Tuesday, and on Tuesday it was announced that a ceasefire deal was reached. I'm very suspect, Stephen. I read the sketchy terms. You know, it sounds like Israel gave a little bit, but I quoted their Prime Minister, Netanyahu, who I have described very aptly, I think, saying he is a world-class thug. And, I mean, he literally has no concern for human life whatsoever. And as far as striking a deal with this guy, you might as well strike a deal with a rattlesnake. You might have a better chance with the snake than with this guy. But the statement from him, and I think it was made after the deal was struck, was basically he said, we will do whatever we have to do to defend the Israeli people. So in other words, deal right. or no deal, he'll do anything he damn pleases.
Right, and it's all couched, you know, in terms of defense, and President Obama also talked about the right of Israel to defend itself, which is fine, but we've seen already basically examples of strike and destroy. We've seen tremendous civilian casualties. So going back to what you said a little bit earlier, it is like the 19th century, but the more shocking thing is we now do have the Geneva Conventions. We do have, on paper, the laws of armed conflict, and it's still like the 19th century. So it's as if those protections are not there. Now, you know, far from just being a legal kind of argument, I think the ramifications of this are just tremendous because this is all going on in the context of tremendous unrest that's been labeled as an Arab Spring in the Arab world. And I think that these kinds of civilian casualties this time around is feeding into a massive collective discontent. So I think it's much more dangerous this time around.
Yeah, it really is. It really is. The Middle East, the entire Middle East literally is on the boil. And I don't know how much people can take, Stephen, but the so-called Arab Spring, which is really a Western term and not a regional term, but there is real, real anger that goes from Morocco in the West all the way over to Oman and the Gulf states and Yemen in the East. I mean, every single country, there is mass discontent with the stuff going on internally in the country, and there are all kinds of protests that break out. Most of it never gets any mention in the major media. But these are angry people that have been denied justice for so long, and they deserve it. And then, of course, you've got the conflict zones. You've got small conflict zones like governments that go around murdering the people who dissent from government policy. I guess you could call that a small conflict zone. And you've got U.S. proxy wars like in Yemen when drones bomb and kill Yemenis who simply want to live free and be from under the yoke of America and the repressive government that's really a Western puppet, and the same thing going on in Bahrain, which is absolutely nightmarish. I must have written 10 articles on Bahrain, a recent one I got out a couple of days ago, and it goes on and on across the region, and then you get all-out wars. The Iraq war didn't end. It still goes on. There are multiple car bombs that go off
in
every day. People are dying.
Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. And Afghanistan, of course.
Oh, Afghanistan, for sure. I mean, that's mm-hmm. a raging war, America's longest war, and there's no end to that thing in sight. And what do the Afghans want? They want the Americans out. It's their country. It doesn't belong to America, and they're right.
Right. You know, in a larger context, all the focus has been on the military aspects of these wars and on, like you said, the misnomer of an Arab Spring. But what I find interesting is that the general Petraeus scandal, which I think there's so much, you know, going on beneath and behind it, but everyone's forgetting that it was General Petraeus who was the father of COIN doctrine, COIN being counterinsurgency. In other words, there was the belief early on, maybe like 5 years ago, that the United States cannot win militarily, just militarily. It has to win hearts and minds. It was Petraeus's idea. And so the scandal that he's embroiled in now, of course, the media is much more interested in the tantalizing, sexual, you know, gossipy kinds of aspects of the story about the mistress and so forth. But really what's going on is with his demise, it's also the demise of COIN doctrine, which has been basically thrown out the window. I mean, these drone strikes, they're against the rules of war. I mean, again, you know, you're not supposed to strike at targets in which civilians can be killed. So I think there's so much going on that the media is not looking at the full picture. It's just looking at the more tantalizing, gossipy sorts of aspects of it.
Oh, absolutely. And they're also playing on the assassination of Ambassador Stevens in Benghazi and blaming that on related to this business. But really, the concern is less about Petraeus and more about Obama, because the Republicans look for any way to beat up on Obama.
Right.
wrote one article on the Petraeus affair, and I discovered that in 2010, he testified before two congressional committees, House and Senate, and he did what is the unforgivable in the eyes of the U.S. power structure. He confronted the Israeli lobby, and he confronted Israel. And he said, basically, when U.S. and Israeli policies differ, in other words, when going along with Israeli policies harms America, then America should cut Israel loose and simply not go that way. And
right.
he said that to two congressional committees. Well, I never knew that, and I think if there's one reason why he was, I don't think he resigned, I think he was sacked. If there was one reason why he was sacked, it was because of that. You go up against the Israeli lobby, you know, it's like getting into a 150-mile-an-hour wind and standing out there and saying, blow me away, I dare you. Well, it'll blow you away.
Yeah, you have to wonder about something obvious, and that is he, Petraeus, was CIA director, and those guys are masters at keeping secrets and at spying. And then we're told that, you know, he was discovered, his affair was discovered so easily, and that he used Gmail to communicate with his mistress. I mean, surely the director of the CIA would have been more secretive and would have found other ways, you know, to not be discovered. So I tend to agree with you. It's very suspicious, the timing of his being sacked, you know, right before the Benghazi hearings really got underway, and also around the same time that Israel is attacking Gaza. So the timing is interesting, and the circumstances, like I said, the fact that he was, you know, the major spy master and could have messed up so badly in being found out, that's just very curious.
I absolutely discount the sexual business, Stephen. I don't think it had anything whatsoever to do with it. There have been so many prominent people in U.S. history who have had mistresses and love, call them what you will. I mean, you can go back in history. There were rumors unproved about George Washington. I'm not sure if it was true or not. Thomas Jefferson, for sure. I don't know about Lincoln. He probably had just cause to have a mistress. Franklin Roosevelt, Jack Kennedy. There were rumors, maybe possibly true about the senior and junior Bush, Lyndon Johnson. I mean, it goes on and on and on. These people, they're presidents of the United States. I mean, CIA guy has to keep secrets. So does the president.
Mm-hmm.
And pillow talk can reveal an awful lot. So this stuff goes on all the time. I mentioned Newt Gingrich in my article when he was Speaker of the House. He survived a sex and an ethics scandal, and he resigned from Congress in 1998, not because of those two things, because the Republicans had a bad off-year election. They lost a lot of seats to the Democrats. So, you know, the boss takes the fall, and then Bob Livingston was the designee to take his place. He had a sex scandal. He resigned. But it had nothing to do with the sex scandal. He decided it was a better option to become a high-priced Washington lobbyist. They didn't give a damn how many people he slept with.
I agree, of course. And you forgot Bill Clinton.
Bill Clinton, of course.
and of course, another irony is that Gingrich was the one that led the attack to impeach Bill Clinton. And at the time he was doing it, Gingrich was having affairs.
Indeed.
And it's all political, But it seems that the media is just buying it, you know, without question, without going into depth, without any real analysis. I mean, they're just buying this. Oh, Petraeus had an affair, so he had to resign. I mean, you know, I'm very suspicious, like you say, of that kind of reasoning. It just seems too easy, too pat.
Oh, it really does. And, I mean, that's one issue. And, you know, it made headlines for a number of days. I don't know how long the Republicans will beat up on it or want to use it, but it'll pass. And there'll be a new CIA director. I think it'll pass for sure if they can come up with a juicier scandal. They'll bash Obama people. If they come up with a juicy one, they'll forget about Petraeus and use that. So I love the old quote by Harry Truman way back when he said, "If you want a friend in Washington, get a dog."
Yeah.
It was that way then, and it sure is that way now.
Right.
Can I just mention a couple of things about Gaza? I've certainly discussed it before, and today is an important day. Today, Tuesday, when we're taping, is an important day because the so-called ceasefire was announced. It doesn't take place until midnight Gaza time, Israeli time, which is 7 hours. I believe it's 7 hours later than Eastern time. So we're moving along. We've still got a few hours to go, and I was following headlines after the truce, so-called truce, was announced, and the rockets are still going in response to Israeli attacks. Israel is still bombing Gaza, still targeting individuals they want to kill, and mostly they're killing civilians. And so Hamas responds, and other resistance groups respond. It's their right to respond under international law. If you're attacked, self-defense is absolutely a right under international law. But there are so many ugly threads to what's going on. People don't realize, Stepan, that to conduct a military campaign like this, it's not quite up to the level of a war, but it's a major campaign that's gone on for days. There were over 1,000 Israeli sorties flown. The last I checked, there were over 1,400 targets hit. 1,400 targets hit. Imagine the time and planning that went into choosing those targets. It took months. It took months. So they call this thing Operation Pillar of Cloud. This is from a quote out of the book of Exodus. You know, defiling the Bible to justify your slaughter. And then they begin. Israel provoked this. Multiple Israeli provocations finally got Hamas and other resistance groups to respond. And when they did, Israel launched this conflict. And they did it for a number of reasons. And a key one was the head of the resistance brigade, the Qassam brigades in Gaza, a man named Ahmad Jabari. And I wrote an article specifically about him. He was a very important man. He was more than a military leader. He was a political leader. And right before the conflict began, within hours or within a day or so, he had a draft truce agreement in hand, agreed to by both sides, because Israel agrees and then it violates its agreement. But Israel agreed, and Hamas and the other groups in Gaza, or at least most of them, agreed to ceasefire terms. He had enough clout in Gaza to bring along the other groups. And Israel absolutely did not want peace, Stepan. Israel thrives on violence and instability, and this has been its entire history since 1948 and before 1948. So Israel deliberately subverted the peace that was at hand. It literally was consummated, just like the deal announced today. And Israel murdered Jabari to prevent peace, and the conflict started. And we don't really know how many Palestinians have died. The official number is about 130 or so. I think the real number is double that, because there's rubble all over the place and there are bodies underneath it. So when they finally dig it all out, they'll find out how many people died. And some people are so badly hurt, they won't be able to save them. So they'll die. And many, many children are affected. It's horrible. Women, children, civilian homes have been targeted. That's what this war is. That's the way Israel fights its wars. And, of course, the U.S. media covers it all up. They say nothing.
Right. But what really concerns me is that why do we have Geneva Conventions and the laws of armed conflict, which prohibit the killing of women and children and civilians, if conflict after conflict, not just this one, but, you know, you can go back as far as you want, including World War II, and it's ignored. You know, November 18th was the 21st anniversary of something nobody will notice or remember, and that was Vukovar, which was the first city in Croatia that the Serbs attacked. And again, they deliberately attacked the hospital in Vukovar, where they carted off about 260 wounded people and then just slaughtered them in a cattle shed, and then there was a mass grave, and of course they were deliberately shooting civilian targets. And at the time that was happening, again, it's just strange when the media covers it that the idea of these being war crimes, the idea that these are things prohibited by, you know, all the progress that we supposedly have made since the 19th century, that never seems to come up. So, you know, in addition to what you're saying, you know, each side is going to rationalize what it's doing and why. I'm just astounded by the fact that just collectively we don't seem to care about all the safeguards that we supposedly have in place to prevent this sort of thing. Isn't that kind of strange to you?
Oh, it's strange and very disturbing. I must say, Stip, and I remember Vukovar. I remember it, and I remember the conflict there going way back, well back into the 1990s, and then so much else that followed. And behind the scenes, America was manipulating so much. I think Germany was very much involved in manipulating. Diana Johnstone wrote an important book about what happened throughout the 1990s, and she covered so much important ground. And it's been a while. I read the book, but it was so many years ago, I'd have to go back and refresh my memory. But they were just wonderful comments written about how she covered the entire event. But it was a great tragedy. And in all of these things, Stepan, as you and I know, ordinary people are the ones who suffer most.
Right.
The collateral damage, the ordinary people, that they can't get out of the way of the bombs and the bullets and the rest of it, and they suffer
absolutely
so horrendously. So it's the same for the Palestinians. It's civilians that suffer most. And in all wars, it's always civilians who suffer most.
Right. But we're supposed to have progressed.
Yeah, I have very, very, very jaded feelings about the human species. I don't know whoever decided that this is a higher species. We're the only species I know that goes around exterminating itself. Other species don't do that. The so-called, the lower ones, they don't exterminate themselves. You know, they kill to eat and for protection and to protect their territory and stuff like that. But they don't go around, you know, en masse or hired guns or whatever, just killing for the sake of killing. But the human species is different, and it does that. One group against another, one nation against another, and the killing goes on endlessly. And it's shocking to say, and it's true, that America literally has a permanent war policy. Who ever heard of a democratic country with a permanent war policy? Well, I would never call America a democracy, and it does have a permanent war policy. And I've written a fair amount about that, Stepan. It's shocking, and it's pretty disturbing.
Yes, it is.
Anyway, I'll let you jump into whatever other topics we can get into and discuss. I mean, if we want to talk about wars, oh boy! I mean, there are so many going on. I can't imagine. I've said this as well in stuff that I've written. You know, there's a lot of talk about a drawdown in Afghanistan and leaving at the end of 2014. America doesn't come to war theaters to leave. America plans permanent occupation. There's a permanent occupation of Iraq. There's a permanent occupation plan of Afghanistan. And what they'll do is they'll draw down troops to whatever force level they want. They'll recruit local forces to act in their behalf. I don't know how well it's working in Iraq. I think a little better there than in Afghanistan, where what's the term they use? Red on blue, or blue on red, or something or other, where the local troops that have been hired end up shooting the Americans and the other occupiers. I can't imagine why they all don't do that. I mean, it's their country, and they're being occupied, and they're being exploited, and they're being harmed so much. I just can't imagine why they all haven't taken the guns and training they've gotten and turned it on the real enemy, which is not their own government. It's the occupying powers, and that's mainly America. And this literally could go on forever. That war in Afghanistan literally could go on forever until America actually gets tied and says, we got to get out of here, the way they did in Vietnam. They finally left because they really had no choice. And for the Vietnamese, first with the French, and they always wanted good relations with America after World War II, but beginning with the French. I mean, they fought a 30-year war to finally be free, but it turned out that they won the battle and they lost the war because now they play with neoliberal harshness, and they basically lost everything they supposedly fought for. Pretty awful.
Yeah, one of the related themes to what you're saying is the people who, and you mentioned this when you were introducing me, the people who pay the price in terms of going to jail for these crimes that are committed due to the policies are always the low-ranking ones. And it seems like, again, in the past decade, no one's really paying attention to the many soldiers now who have been sent to Fort Leavenworth, all of them low-ranking, extremely low-ranking. Not a single general or colonel or major has ever been court-martialed for issuing some of these orders that violate the laws of armed conflict. And even that's different if you go back to the Vietnam War, because when Lieutenant Calley was convicted, there was an outpouring. Thousands of letters were sent to President Nixon, and Nixon pardoned him. And I always thought that was a little bit odd until I saw what the prosecutor in the case said, which was, at that time, the American people were against the war, and they took on the responsibility for what the United States did in Vietnam. And they, you know, as a whole, collectively, most Americans, concluded that it was not the responsibility of Cali, but it was national responsibility. Well, there's nothing of that sort now. It's more like, okay, you know, somebody's gone to jail, so we've solved whenever these incidents do come to light. And it's just brushed under the rug, and no one's looking into it very deeply. So, again, it's kind of a disturbing trend. Leavenworth is absolutely full of young Americans who, like you said earlier, were following orders and following unlawful policies.
Yeah, but if I remember right, there was a major involved, an Army major involved in trying to cover up the Cali episode, and the major's name was Colin Powell, who later became chief of staff. I mean, that's how ugly it gets. A guy who, you know, became a person of some repute, and he was he was of repute indeed, all ill repute. So he was involved then because of service to the empire, like covering up massacres and so on. He got promoted up the ranks and finally got 4 stars and headed up the whole military operation, then Secretary of State and the whole shebang. And if he wanted to, he could have run for president, and he probably would have been elected. He didn't want to. Yep. I think the only reason he didn't run is I think he thought that maybe the first black guy might be assassinated. Well, you never know. You never know. I mean, you know, if you follow the imperial line, I think you've got enough phalanxes around you to protect you. You only get in trouble when you go off on your own and you decide you want to do the right thing instead of the wrong thing. Then they will come get you, and all those phalanxes will turn out to be your enemy. The Praetorian Guard will be your assassins.
I mean, that's the way it was in Roman times, that's for sure. No, but you're absolutely right. He was the major who was responsible for that cover-up. And, of course, the orders for that My Lai massacre went way, way up the chain of command, just like for all the incidents that are happening now go way up the chain of command. But it's all been absolved. No one's looking at it. No one's examining it. So these grand scenarios that you're portraying, it's all it all comes down to scapegoating just a few people at the bottom as a way to resolve the problem instead of looking at it deeply and asking hard questions of how we can really win. Because, again, I'm going back to an earlier point. You can never win any war on purely military grounds. In the end, you have to make peace with your enemies, and you have to make peace with the people that you've subjugated. And that seems to be the hardest thing for the government to learn.
Yeah, it's so true. It's absolutely so true. And so you literally have festering feelings that go on. If the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is ever resolved one day, Stepan, this thing has gone on since the 1940s, and really before that, because the Palestinians were literally screwed, not just by Britain, the colonial master, and the West overall. They really got nothing, and it goes back to the early part of the 20th century. It's getting close to a full century, but their rights were completely spurned. And I wonder how many generations it would take to change that and turn that around and heal the wounds that are so deep. I just can't imagine.
Right.
If I was a Palestinian, I mean, I'm not a Palestinian, and I absolutely won't forgive for what was done to them. I'm Jewish, but I'm proud to call myself. I literally say this: I am a Palestinian because I support them so much in their great struggle, and I know that they're on their own, and only they can win on their own somehow. And it could take who knows how long. Stefan, let's take a very quick break, and we'll come back, and we'll jump into all the other big stuff that's going on.
Okay.
Major events going on in the world, whether it's Israel-Palestine, whether it's the Balkans, Afghanistan, Iraq, the horrible wars that unfortunately the country we both live in, America, the so-called democracy, is responsible for these wars. They never would have been fought if America didn't want to fight them for its imperial agenda. And I'm unequivocal about it, Stefan. I say America's agenda is very simple. It wants unchallenged global dominance, nothing less. And it's willing to do anything it takes to get that. You know, if you can do it by coup d'etats and get rid of an independent government and put in a puppet regime, all well and good. And if that doesn't succeed, then get a little harsher. And if all the measures don't succeed, short of war, the final option is go to war. And America fights so many of them. And besides, America wants to fight some wars because the profiteers demand it. There's so much money to be made in these wars, the trillions of dollars that have been spent. And I think there are buried amounts that we don't even know about because there are supplemental add-ons, there are black budgets, there's all kinds of stuff that pours, I don't know how many hundreds of billions of dollars into the business of war making, and this has gone on as far back since America is, well, since, let's just take it back to World War II. World War II, America was a little less belligerent before then, not entirely, but a little less. But post-World War II, it literally has been nonstop war from one to another, and either direct or proxy or involved in indirectly in some way. And again, the enormous amount of money spent on militarism, I honestly believe, and I've said it, that America spends more on what it calls defense. I call it lawless aggression, including what goes on at home, more than the rest of the world combined. You know, the official numbers don't approach that kind of a statement, but the unofficial numbers do. And when you talk about America's defense, there are so many categories to be included. It goes a lot more than the official annual military defense budget. There are many more categories than that. And to pay for all of this, homeland needs go begging, whether it's vital people needs, whether it's the infrastructure. I saw a comment today, I forget what website I saw it on, but it said something like America would have to spend, if I remember the number, $225 billion annually up until at least 2050, I think was the date, at least to 2050, to begin putting the rundown U.S. infrastructure anywhere near close to being back to the minimal standards it should be at. It's been so neglected. And I think another comment made in what I saw, if I remember the percentage right, I think it said America right now is spending 50 or 60% of what it needs annually. So the longer it neglects the infrastructure, the worse off and more expensive it becomes to fix it. And the money is going to the bankers, to the other corporations, and to waging war. And that's what America does.
Right. Before World War II, America was isolationist. So you're right. It pretty much stayed out of conflicts. But one of the most famous lines out of World War II was when President Eisenhower warned against the military-industrial complex. So really what you're talking about is this, you know, military-industrial complex. And it's kind of odd that term, which has been used by sociologists, some of them since then, it's hardly ever mentioned anymore in recent times. It's almost like it's become passé. It's certainly not analyzed. It's not seen as, you know, a cautionary light, something to avoid. So the description that you're making, neglecting the infrastructure, in favor of this complex. It seems to be like, you know, like drinking water. It's like just the new norm, the new normal. And what you were saying earlier, I mean, we saw the terrible state of the infrastructure with Hurricane Sandy. And, you know, I don't know how many other hurricanes have to hit us before we see, you know, the fact that, for example, some of the electrical transformers were buried in the tunnels or buried underneath Manhattan, which doesn't seem like a very smart place to put electrical transformers. And a lot of them were just so outdated. You know, you're absolutely right. I mean, that's where the money should be going to make us again more modern. But I don't see that being analyzed, certainly not in academia.
No, it sure isn't. And talk about how unprepared New York and maybe some of the other areas in the Northeast were to deal with Sandy. Another comment that I saw was the only protected areas were around the corporate headquarters, where they were pretty safe from any flood wash coming in and causing harm. But lower Manhattan was in big trouble. Staten Island was in big trouble. And, right. You know, sooner or later you're going to have a hurricane hit. It could be a problem. And this one wasn't even a hurricane. It was a tropical storm.
Right.
You know, they called it a giant storm because it covered a large swath of geography. But it wasn't a hurricane. Wind speeds, 50 miles an hour, 60 miles an hour. Why should something like this cause so much harm? My God, I mean, to the most important city in the country. And they're still struggling to come back, and there are communities that have been neglected. I wrote about the aftermath of Sandy, and I compared New York, especially to what happened in New Orleans after Katrina. It was nightmarish. I mean, the people that were washed out of their communities on valued land that the developers wanted, 7 years later, they never got to go home. And I think
right.
we're going to see some of the same things happen in New York.
Right. No, I mean, you're absolutely correct. It's a militarist kind of orientation and not geared towards civilian infrastructure.
And the rights of ordinary human beings, you know, if they have public housing, I think public housing is going to take a hit in New York. And I saw numbers like 40,000 need to be housed. I hope that's close to the right number. Well, people swept out of their homes. I think what the city wants to do is get rid of the public housing and not replace it. So where are these people going to live? I mean, rents in New York are outrageously expensive if they don't have some kind of subsidy to be able to live on the poverty wages they get. What are they going to do, sleep in the street?
No, they'll move to other communities. You know, after Katrina, the people who, a lot of them came as refugees to Texas, from what everything I've heard and read around here, they're still in Texas. There's no place for them, like you said, to go back to New Orleans.
Oh, that was so true. I think a lot of those people were forced out and literally transported to these other areas, whether it was Texas or upstate Louisiana. They wanted to get
exactly.
them out of New Orleans, and so many of them were never allowed to go back. And I think this will happen in New York as well.
Exactly. Which is, again, a kind of a 19th century pre-modern phenomenon, you know, a disaster being used to basically change the demographics of American communities.
And there's a term for it. It's called ethnic cleansing.
Yes, I was trying to avoid the term, Stephen.
Oh, boy. Well, I quoted a former congressman in Louisiana who, after Katrina, made the statement, and I think I can come pretty close to his exact words. He said, "What authorities couldn't do, Mother Nature did for them. Got rid of the black people that the developers wanted to get rid of, so they could put up upscale projects, and they were very pleased about that. And I'm very suspicious about some of these so-called natural events. That maybe they're not quite as natural as people think." I saw a very disturbing video. I don't think I mentioned this on air before. Somebody sent it to me, a friend, and said, "You got to watch this." It ran about 13 minutes, and I don't have much time to watch videos, but I took the time to watch this one, and it showed the path of Sandy veering out to sea at least twice on the video, and then mysteriously, it seemed to be directed back toward shore, aiming right at New York and the New Jersey area, really the heavily populated areas, especially New York. And once it veered in, and it veered back out again, and then it veered in again. It just wasn't happening naturally. It looked like there was some manipulation engineering going on that was steering this storm toward New York. And why would this be done? Well, the only reason I can think is to, make life profitable for the people who want to take advantage of this stuff, and letting ordinary people who have no power pay for it. And it's very possible that that's what went on, plus the lack of protection. New Orleans, a different kind of city than New York. New Orleans sits below sea level. I think Lower Manhattan is maybe just a few feet above sea level.
Right.
But New Orleans sits below sea level, and the levees were deliberately left weak in the areas that they didn't care about their being flooded, and maybe in some other places they were bolted and strong. And this was proved in analysis afterwards, that you could see how weak the levees were, and they were allowed to be weak. And I remember writing in an article, and then I repeated it in the article I wrote about Sandy, that FEMA in 2001 predicted three almost certain U.S. catastrophes sooner or later. One was an earthquake in San Francisco, a major earthquake in San Francisco. Another one was a terrorist attack in New York. Well, San Francisco had one earlier, and they're long overdue for another big one. They'll get it one of these days. The New York terror attack happened. And the third one was a devastating hurricane in New Orleans, and they sure got that in 2005. And, this stuff was well known, and nobody did anything to prepare for them.
How do you explain the manipulation of Sandy to go into New York City? Are you saying that somebody or some organization is able to control the weather in those areas?
There's a technology called HAARP, H-A-A-R-P, and I wrote about it a few years ago. It's very, very secretive stuff. But supposedly this technology is powerful enough to cause hurricanes, direct them, cause forest fires, cause earthquakes, cause other natural disasters, and they're a U.S. I don't know what you would call it, but U.S. facility, technological facility set up in places like Alaska and other places, where literally you can create weather events and make things happen. I felt very strongly, and I wrote about HAARP when after the Haiti earthquake happened in January 2010, and that earthquake just didn't sit with me like it was something that happened naturally. And I had to wonder, why on earth would Haiti have been targeted? If it really was an engineered earthquake, why would that be the case? I mean, Haiti is poor. What is there in Haiti that's so valuable? Well, I discovered one thing that's very valuable. There are very large oil deposits offshore, very large. So the profiteers want to get their hands on them. They don't want Haiti to have them. They want to have them for themselves. And also the developers wanted to get their hands on valued property in and around the capital, Port-au-Prince. So there were so many people displaced, and so many of them, it'll be 3 years later in January, haven't been allowed to come home. They were displaced, many of them living on the streets and tents, makeshift, whatever they can put up that is nothing at all. I mean, nothing against the elements if you get heavy rains and all kinds of, you don't get freezing cold weather, but you have very, very troublesome weather you have to deal with. And if you're living under a bed sheet for an overhead covering, I mean, you have no protection at all. And so little was done for these people. And they simply exploit them more than they've already been exploited. But I think that was an unnatural event, and I can't prove it, but that was my feeling. And whether Sandy was unnatural or Katrina, I can't prove it, but I'm very suspicious, Stephen.
Is this HAARP under government or private or some combination of both control?
It's government controlled. It's government controlled. Now, whether there are any private corporations involved in this, they certainly have to build a technology. Whether they know what it's going to be used for, I don't know. But it's run by the government, the Pentagon or whatever. And I think it's accepted that this technology can cause weather events, and just how sophisticated it is, I can only guess. But I have a feeling that it is sophisticated,
that's
and it can
pretty
do
horrible.
Stuff like this.
But But one of the things I do remember early on when Sandy was just forming, the Weather Channel was showing the computer models, and they were not hitting New York. They were making it go off the coast of Nova Scotia, you know, into the Atlantic. So it is a bit odd that it took this decisive turn to the left. I mean, clearly. I remember that. And they dropped the early models completely. They just sort of disappeared.
If you saw the video that I did, it was a real video. It was very, very disturbing to watch that, to literally see the path of the hurricane shift. And even, mm-hmm. I mean, it looked like it was definitely heading offshore. And at 50, 60-mile-an-hour winds, you know, so New York would have gotten some heavy rain, but nothing approaching the amount to flood the city. But it happened. And then you watch this storm get veered directly toward New York. I mean, this never happened to New York before. Just imagine if it was ever a real hurricane. I mean, that really would have been a disaster.
Right. That's very scary.
We have some ugly people, ugly people with ugly policies running this country, Stepan. It's shocking. I mean, there's no consideration for the people at home, no consideration abroad. You get policies that go back so far. I remember writing, I think it was 1973, that Henry Kissinger came up with a policy, NSSM, if I remember the letters properly, NSSM 200, and his plan was to exterminate 500 million people by a date that might have been 2000 or so. So give it 25 or so years, exterminate 500 million people, and then every year after that, exterminate another 100 million people. You know, too many people around who are using up resources that the profiteers want to be able to sell and make more money, and they don't want these people using their resources. This guy wins a Nobel Peace Prize, and you know, I mean, mass murdering people, murdering them is too slow. You know, starving them to death, feeding them toxic foods, polluting their environment. There are other ways besides going to war that can kill people much faster. Starvation and disease are wonderful ways to get rid of people. These are the kind of things that he was advocating. And I mean, you fight your wars too. And if they're big enough, you can kill an awful lot of people. But the people who die from hunger and disease every year, it's been a good while since I've taken a look at those figures, but I think that they are pretty massive.
Right, and of course that was the exact method that was used in exterminating Native Americans.
Oh, that's right. Smallpox blankets and stuff like that.
Right,
and,
right.
I mean, it just goes on. Again, a higher species, some higher species. And we do it at home with the deprivation that's caused. And healthcare is so expensive, and Obama's healthcare plan it makes the healthcare providers very, very rich, and it really is not doing an awful lot for people who need healthcare. Even the ones that get a plan, it leaves a lot of gaps that they have to fill in, and if they can't afford it, they don't get the care they need. If it's expensive, you can't get it. If it's a ordinary doctor visit and cheap stuff, you can get it. But what happens if you come up with a serious illness and they're all extremely expensive? Well, how do you get care if you can't afford it because the insurance won't cover it? An awful lot of people are going to perish, and it's going to get worse and worse and worse. And again, we call this progressive reform. People call Obama a liberal. I can't imagine calling him a liberal.
Yeah, one of the things I recall reading about Ulysses S. Grant is the first battle that he led against the Confederacy. He wrote in his diary that he concluded from the resistance that he met that the Civil War would have to be, in his exact words, a war of extermination, because the Confederates were so difficult to subdue that the policy would be one of extermination, which is another name for strike and destroy. And, of course, that's what followed with Sherman's March to the Sea, and with many other policies towards the Confederacy. So I think there's deep roots to this strike and destroy philosophy if you trace them back in American history, the way that the Civil War was fought, the way that the U.S. Army was involved in exterminating Native Americans are two major examples of that.
Well, I think that's absolutely true, and the Civil War was the most destructive in terms of lives lost in U.S. history, even in raw numbers. And it's been a while, but I remember writing about the lives lost, which were 600-odd thousand, with a tiny population compared to today. It probably was 4 or 5 years ago that I wrote the article I'm thinking about, but I extrapolated and said if the same proportional number of lives to population totals were lost in a war waged today, it would be something like 12 million American lives lost.
Wow.
In World War II, it was about 360,000. In the Civil War, it was pretty close to twice that number with a tiny population.
Right.
And if that same proportion were lost in a U.S. war today, it would be 12 million. And it's got to be higher now because I wrote that article some years ago, 4 or 5 years ago. So maybe it would be 15 million now. I mean, that's pretty shocking to think about. And
yes,
again,
it is.
The people who wage these wars don't care. Again, human life is of no value to them, only their goals. The profits they make and the power that they get, those are the only things that matter, nothing else. That stuff bothers me. It really bothers me. I care about other people, and I just can't imagine being able to sleep easy thinking that if I were the guy in charge of saying do this, do that, that's causing so much harm, nobody could pay me enough to soothe my feelings that, I'm being well compensated for the job I do. There's no amount that could soothe my feelings. I simply couldn't do anything like that.
Right. Well, that's first of all because you have a conscience. And second of all, what's going on is that, like I said, you know, all the countries in the civilized world have a doctrine of command responsibility. But the only time that they use it, that is, punish people on top, are on non-Western people. So The Hague is using it in the former Yugoslavia, but the former Yugoslavia is seen as less than European, as, you know, less than fully civilized. So it's okay to do that to them. But if you think back on Srebrenica, that was a Dutch commander who allowed General Mladic to conduct that slaughter against the Muslims. There was a full-blown investigation. They did find the Dutch commander culpable. They found the entire United Nations chain of command culpable because he was radioing what was going on. The UN decidedly refused to call in airstrikes, refused to let it stop. They were watching it in real time. But, you know, the end to that story is nobody in the chain of command in the West, in the United Nations, is brought up before The Hague. So, you know, it's a double standard. We're going to hold people accountable who are very susceptible to being held accountable. That's low-ranking soldiers in the West and high-ranking officials in countries that are considered less than Western. So there's a real double standard going on.
There really is, Stephen. We're just about out of time, and I want to give you the final comment. I'll just make a very quick one. The same story was true in Rwanda in the early 1990s, the so-called genocide. None of that ever had to have happened. None of it had to have happened, but it
right.
was manipulated and allowed to happen, and who knows how many people died, but it was awful. An awful lot of people died absolutely needlessly, and it was because of the Western imperial ambitions in the area, and they had their thug, a man named Paul Bagami, who was trained at Fort Riley, Kansas, I think, and he was their mass murderer in charge of administering U.S. imperial policy. But again, we're just about out of time. Just a final comment from you, Stephen.
Well, you know, in terms of our disturbing discussion today, which, you know, really sobering and serious, I'm just wondering where are all the peace institutes and all the academic associations out there that are supposed to be promoting peace and studying peace and how to achieve peace? I mean, I think we need to hear more from them instead of just the same old military-industrial complex stuff.
We sure do. It's long overdue. I'm sick and tired of these wars without end and the mass killing and the suffering and so on, and ordinary people needs at home going begging. I'm sick and tired of it. It sure gives me plenty to write about, Stephen. I look forward to getting you back. We are plumb out of time. It was great having you on.
Thank you for having me.
Won't let this
I
much time
it.
Go by without getting you back. I promise you that.
I enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you, Stephen. And join us either live or on occasional holiday weekends like Thanksgiving, Christmas, and New Year's. We will pre-record and join us on Fridays at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, on weekends at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.